Lowe's knows how to help make your home holiday ready for less. Get Select Style Selections vinyl flooring for just $1.99 per square foot and have it installed before the festivities begin. Our team can help you every step of the way. See a Lowe's Red Vest associate or visit lowes.com/holiday install to get started. Lowe's, we help, you save. Basic install only. Date restrictions apply. Subject to availability. Install by independent contractor. See associate for details. Contiguous U.S. only.
At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
Hey guys, and welcome to Mysteries and Histories with me, your host, Georgia Marie. This podcast audio is adapted from my YouTube channel. I wanted to make my content more accessible for those of you on the go, and we all love a podcast. So if I ever reference anything on screen or a photograph, please bear in mind this audio was originally made for video. It won't hinder your listening experience at all, but just to save any confusion. And if you do want to go and subscribe to my channel, I'm just Georgia Marie over on YouTube. And with that, let's get into it. From 1978 to 1988, a killer roamed New England in the USA, responsible for the murders of at least seven young women in the Connecticut River Valley area, aptly becoming known as the Connecticut River Valley Killer. To this day, the murderer has never been identified, and there's every chance he could still be out there somewhere, maybe committing different crimes, maybe hiding in the shadows. Who was he? Like, how can somebody kill seven people, attack even more, and never be found? His crimes only seemed to stop when his last known victim in 1988 managed to escape, and it seems the potential of a living witness might have spooked him into stopping, or at least spooked him into changing his entire MO. And don't let the Connecticut in the name here confuse you, many of the victims are actually found in New Hampshire and Vermont. It's just that the Connecticut River is the longest river in New England. It flows through four states for 406 miles, starting just south of the US border under Quebec and finishing at Long Island Sound. The valley through which the river runs is home to a lot of farmland. The soil is really good quality, and historically farmers used the river to easily transport their goods. But it just means nowadays there's lots of agricultural land, fields and fields as far as the eye can see, and plenty of wooded space in which to hide bodies. And that is why the Connecticut Valley River Killer chose this area in which to dispose of his victims. The investigation into this case remains open to this very day, but it's not very well known, and there's really not that much information available about this case. I bet a lot of you have never even heard of this killer before. I know I certainly hadn't before somebody requested it. With just a little bit more awareness, I do wonder if this is a case that really could be solved, even 40 years on. Our story begins on Tuesday, October 24th, 1978, when 27-year-old Catherine Milliken, known as Kathy to everyone, left work around 5 p.m. She headed to the Chandler Brook Wetland Preserve in New London in New Hampshire to photograph some birds. Friends say she was very interested in bird watching. Now, anyone who's been around here for any period of time will know that I do always try my hardest to share personal stories, anecdotes of the victims in all the cases I talk about. I want to make these stories about the victims over the perpetrators. However, in some cases, like this one, there just isn't that much to be found online, especially when the crime has seemingly flown under the radar for so many decades. It doesn't seem like Kathy's friends or family have ever really shared much with the media about her case, and therefore we don't know loads about her, which is a shame but also completely understandable. Her body would be found by state police bloodhounds just a couple of days after she disappeared, and again, I couldn't find loads of information out there about what happened after Kathy's disappearance, like who reported her as missing. But I do know she was reported as missing the very next day, on the Wednesday. On the Tuesday when she first disappeared, a police officer had been doing his patrols in this area and he noticed two cars in the parking lot, but obviously didn't think anything of it and just moved on. The next day, when Kathy was reported as missing in this area, it was noted that she drove a Volkswagen Rabbit, just like one of the cars that this officer had seen the night before, and he reported it just in case. And he was correct to do so because this car that he saw in the parking lot was indeed hers. When Kathy was found, she was lying in the woods, her skirt had been pulled down, and the killer had made a slight attempt to disguise her, although they didn't really go to that much effort. She was just sort of partially covered with some brush. An autopsy revealed that she died from multiple stab wounds, over 20 in total, to her chest, neck, back, abdomen and thighs, and this was a frenzied and violent attack, something you'll see became a bit of a pattern in the victims. This killer is somebody who wanted violence, who wanted blood. It wasn't somebody who was just sort of like content with shooting somebody from a distance. They got up close and personal and they wanted to inflict pain. It wasn't known at what point she died after 5 p.m. on that Tuesday after she arrived at the wetlands, but I would guess it was sometime early that evening. When looking for evidence, her possessions were found located along the paths in the park, so they found her car keys, her binoculars and just a few other random bits. They also found some forensic evidence as well. They found strands of her hair and markings on the pathway, and using this, they were able to make a kind of reconstruction of the attack. From this, it seemed like the killer spotted Kathy and waited for her patiently, unknowingly trapping her in a certain area. Like he hid in a spot that he knew that she was going to have to walk past if she wanted to get back to her car. And then as she did so, he pounced, grabbing her and dragging her along the path before stabbing her to death in one location before moving her body to where it would later be found. It's thought that when the police officer drove by, noting Kathy's car in the car park, the killer must have only been hiding a few feet away. The big question has always been whether the other car in the parking lot was that of the killer's, and I couldn't really find any details about this, but that could be something investigators have kept very close to their chest. Despite the fact that Kathy's skirt had been pulled up and her clothes were generally found in disarray, there was no evidence that she had been sexually assaulted. Now, of course, that's not to say it absolutely didn't happen, but there was nothing to say that it absolutely did happen either. Could it be that the perpetrator was cut short in his crime, that he had to escape and leave the scene quickly? Did Kathy enrage him so much that he stabbed her in a frenzy before he could assault her? Was it maybe not sexually motivated at all? Could the disarray just be because of how she was sort of pulled along the pathway? Maybe the motive was purely the violence, wanting to remove a woman from this earth. At this time, the first of what would become many, many murders, they didn't have any clear answers as to any of these questions. For all they knew at this point, this was just a lone, random attack. With the violence of this, you might assume that this was a killer who was frenzied, who wouldn't be able to wait for his next attack. But strangely, the next known victim of the Connecticut River Valley killer wouldn't come along until almost 3 years later. Of course, he may have attacked again in that time, but if he did, it's never really been connected. On July 25th, 1981, Mary Elizabeth, or Betsy Critchley, a student at the University of Vermont, was hitchhiking near Interstate 91 on the border of Vermont and Massachusetts. She was intending on making her way up to Waterbury, Vermont, where she lived with a friend. She was last seen near exit 13 of the Massachusetts Turnpike, where a friend had dropped her off, and then she just disappeared. Her body would be found a couple of weeks later on August 9th in the woods off Unity State Road in Unity, New Hampshire, which is about a 2.5 hour drive northwest of where she was last seen. By the time Betsy's body was found, she was severely decomposed, so the autopsy couldn't really provide any answers as to the cause of her death, but the circumstances surrounding her death were considered to be very suspicious. Some sources said it was considered a homicide at the time, but the Department of Justice website doesn't actually state that outright, so I'm not entirely sure. It doesn't seem like at this point in time her death was linked with that of Kathy's at all. All in all, with this case as a whole, there just isn't loads of information out there. But after Betsy, it seems like the killer took another 3 year break. The next known victim didn't disappear until the 30th of May 1984. 17-year-old Bernice Quartermunch was last seen in Clermont in New Hampshire. She was still a high school student at the time she disappeared, and she was also working as a nurse's aide at a local nursing home in Unity. Yes, the same Unity Betsy was found nearby. Bernice lived in nearby Claremont with her boyfriend Teddy and his parents, but on the day in question, Teddy called her and asked her to come and meet him at his sister's house in Newport. She was at work at this point, she wanted to run home to grab some bits first, so asked a co-worker to drop her back in Claremont, planning to hitchhike from there to Newport. And she hitchhiked all the time, like this was really normal behaviour for her. And this was only a 10-mile journey, like it should have taken less than 20 minutes. We know for sure that Bernice made it back home because Teddy's parents popped home around the same time and reported her in the kitchen eating a sandwich. She told them that she was going to Newport to meet Teddy and they offered her a ride, but she declined. She said it'd be easy enough for her to get a lift, don't worry, she'll sort herself out. Some reports say that she was last seen getting in a car with two men, but neither of these men have ever come forward. Although her case wasn't really very well advertised in those early days, it could well be that these men were suspicious, or it could be that they simply didn't hear of her disappearance. We don't know. I would suspect the former though. From there, no one knows what happened to Bernice. Teddy waited around in Newport for her to arrive, but she never did, and then it got dark. Apparently Bernice was just this incredibly independent person, so when she didn't arrive at first, everyone didn't immediately freak out. Like maybe she'd ran into a friend or something, she was staying the night there, maybe she forgot to let everyone know. Like they weren't super concerned at first. It was weird, but like they weren't worried. But by the next day, when nobody had heard from her, it was officially very strange, and Teddy called the police around midday to report her as missing. In no shock to anyone at first, they would just assume that she was a simple runaway, a 17-year-old girl wanting to leave her boyfriend and not face the consequences. But that would soon change. They did realise eventually that Bernice just had no reason to run away, least of which being she had a $100 paycheck released just a couple of days later, and she never picked it up. Like, if you're going to run away, you at least wait for your latest paycheck, and then you go. She also left all her belongings and all her medication behind as well. Like, this was not a runaway case. Teddy and his family searched endlessly for Bernice. They missed her dearly, but her body wouldn't appear for almost 2 years. In April 1986, human remains were found in a stream in Kellyville. And as so much time had passed, these remains were just bones. But small nicks on the bones, small marks, showed the medical examiner that Bernice was most likely stabbed to death.
Hey, wake up! New drinks just dropped at Wendy's. Cold foam, cold brew coffee, and sparkling energy. Both the caramel and the chocolate cold foam are just, ugh, so good. And the pineapple citrus and cherry limeade sparkling energy each have
80 to 120 milligrams, whew,
of added caffeine. So whether you need a treat first thing or to just stop yawning already, mornings hit different. To pick up a new pick-me-up, gotta be Wendy's. At participating U.S. Wendy's.
This is the story of the one. As a maintenance supervisor at a manufacturing facility, he knows keeping the line up and running is a top priority. That's why he chooses Grainger. Because when a drive belt gets damaged, Grainger makes it easy to find the exact specs for the replacement product he needs. And next day delivery helps ensure he'll have everything in place and running like clockwork. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
By the time she was found though, 2 years on, three more women had already been killed, and this killer was finally working at a much quicker pace. In the early hours of 22nd of July 1984, just months after Bernice disappeared, 26-year-old Ellen Ruth Freed was driving home after work. She was a nurse at Valley Regional Hospital in New Hampshire, and at 2 a.m. that morning, she decided to stop at Leo's Market in Claremont to use the payphone to speak to her sister who lived in California. The time difference meant this was a great time for them to chat, and Ellen didn't have a phone in her apartment, so she had to use a payphone. Whilst on the phone with her sister, Ellen mentioned there was a car just driving back and forth in the parking lot, and it was making her a little bit uneasy. Not bad enough to leave, but like, bad enough to make her mention it to her sister. Before she said bye to her sister, she told her just to hang on the line so she could go back to her car and make sure it was going to start. So Ellen was paying attention to her own safety. She then comes back to the phone, says the car started without a problem, and the sisters chat for a few more minutes before they say goodbye. Now you would assume at this point Ellen went straight back to her car, But she never arrived home and she didn't turn up for work the next day. But Ellen's car wasn't found at home, nor was it found in the parking lot. Her car was actually spotted parked down the side of Jarvis Lane, a quiet dirt road a couple of miles from the payphone, and it was found, I think, the next day. It kind of looked like somebody had abandoned the car there just to go for a walk. It wasn't too suspicious at the time, but a passing officer did run a routine check of the license plates, finding that the car did belong to Ellen Fried. And then the next day, it was still there. A couple of days later, a couple of nurses from the Valley Regional Hospital reported that Ellen had failed to turn up to work on the Friday and the Saturday. And this was incredibly unlike her. She was a very dependable colleague who had just never really done anything like this before. Like, she would always turn up to work. And it became clear that Ellen was officially a missing person. The officers searched around the area the car was found in, but didn't really find any evidence or any clues as to where Ellen had gone. This area was woodland, it was very quiet, but it wasn't really the kind of place that a human could get lost. I mean, you walk 10 minutes in any direction and you just come out to a road. So it's not like she'd wandered into the trees and not been able to find her way back. Like, no, it was really clear that something bad had happened. And weirdly, whilst the local media really picked up on Ellen's story, like, her face was everywhere, no one ever really picked up on Bernice's, and they lived a very similar life. They had stable jobs, stable relationships. They weren't your usual demographic of somebody who had gone missing. They were considered very low-risk people. So why did Ellen's case get so much more attention than Bernice's? Was it just because Ellen was second? Maybe. In September 1985, reports came in that human remains had been found in the woods near the Sugar River. And this was just bones alongside a single sandal. So it could have just been a lost shoe and animal bones, but considering the location on the hillside alongside a track, as if the remains had maybe been thrown from a car, the police thought it was worth checking out. So these remains were sent to a state lab where a dentist compared the teeth with the dental records of three different women who were missing. And they confirmed a match with Ellen Fried. The medical examiner confirmed the cause of death as multiple stab wounds and a probable sexual assault. Undeniably, a pattern was beginning to emerge, but I can't tell you at which point the authorities really started to put the pieces together, like at which point they realised they did indeed have a serial killer in their midst. You'd have to hope it was around this time. Because just before Ellen's remains were found, another woman would also go missing. 27-year-old Eva Marie Morse was last seen hitchhiking near the border of Charlestown in New Hampshire on the 10th of July 1985. Eva was kind of different from the rest of the victims so far, who all seemed to have fairly stable lives, and Eva didn't so much. She'd fallen pregnant and become a single mother when she was just a teenager. She was never quite able to hold onto a stable job and she really struggled with money. It was also widely known in her circles that Eva was a lesbian. Absolutely love that for her. Throughout her 20s, she had multiple female lovers, showing very little interest in men, which is incredibly relatable. Seeing as Eva often struggled for money, spending whatever she did have on her daughter, she never had a car and so she relied on hitchhiking to get around. On the 10th of July, she had gone to work as usual at the box factory, hitchhiking there, and she did arrive. However, she told her manager that she was sick and asked to go home. Whether or not this was the truth, we don't really know. So she immediately turns around and goes to hitchhike back home, or so we can assume. But she never arrived home. When Eva disappeared, a lot of people just assumed she had run away, just left her life. She struggled with her mental health, everyone knew that, and she was a lesbian, therefore she wasn't trustworthy, which is not me saying that, it's just generally what people thought of queer people in this time, still today maybe. The disappearance just wasn't taken all that seriously, but she'd left her daughter behind, and her family knew that she never would have willingly done that. And the police do luckily take her disappearance seriously, probably on the back of all the other women who had also disappeared. There were a few leads in those early days, but the most helpful was a woman who came forward saying that she'd picked up a hitchhiker fitting Eva's description outside the factory early morning on 10th of July. This woman said they headed towards Charlestown, which is where Eva lived, but they drove past it, heading to the Charlestown-Claremont border, which is where the woman was stopping at work. at this workplace, Eva got out and then started immediately thumbing for another lift. This woman seemed to be under the impression that Eva was indeed heading all the way to Claremont, and it doesn't seem like she ever arrived at her destination. In Claremont, it's thought that Eva had a lover called Carol. In April 1986, Eva's body was found in Unity in New Hampshire, just 500 feet from where Betsy Critchley's body had been found. And now that made three cases with links to Unity, because if you remember, Bernice worked there. Like the rest of the victims, Eva's bones were found with knife marks. She had been stabbed to death. Just 10 days before Eva was found, 36-year-old Linda Moore was murdered in Saxton's River in Vermont. Now, Linda's case is slightly different from the rest. Linda was actually at her own home when she was killed. She was just doing work in her yard when she was murdered. Her husband was at work that day, and around 3 p.m. he called home to speak to Linda, but there was no answer, although he'd only spoken to her about an hour or so beforehand. And he thought this was weird, as the kids were due home from school at 3:30, so like she should have been at home. So, worried about his wife, he decides to swing by the house and just make sure that everything was okay, and he found that it very much wasn't. Linda's car was in the driveway and her shoes were by the back door, but upon entering the house, he found Linda lying face down in the doorway from the kitchen to the living room, just lying there in a pool of blood. It was very clear that she had been brutally attacked, her arms slashed down to the bone. A later post-mortem would reveal that she had over 24 stab wounds on her body, and this was a frenzied and violent attack in which she clearly tried really hard to defend herself. There was no sign of forced entry or robbery into the home. Whoever had entered the home had done so purely to attack her. And weirdly, unlike the rest of the cases, there was no effort made to hide or disguise Linda's body. She was just left there in her house for her husband to find. Could it be that maybe the killer was interrupted, or could it be that in this case, he felt no need to hide the body? Maybe her death wasn't connected to the rest. Maybe. With Linda's case being this undeniable murder with no mystery over a disappearance, the police jumped into action straight away, saying they had a number of possible suspects whom they'd administered polygraph tests to. You see, multiple witnesses in this area had reported seeing the same man hanging around near the Moore's home on the day of the murder. He's been described as 20 to 25 years old, clean shaven, with a round face and dark rimmed glasses. A composite sketch of this guy would be released a year later. Which, I don't really know the process behind talking to the witnesses and getting this sketch together, but that seems like way too long to wait to release it. Like, get that composite sketch out there as soon as possible whilst people have fresh memories. Why would you wait a year to release this? Also, please do correct me if I'm wrong, but the man depicted in the composite sketch looks like he could be Asian, maybe? And I couldn't find his ethnicity specified anywhere, which is weird. So I don't know if he was white or maybe Asian or some sort of undisclosed race. I don't know. But Linda Moore's murder just seems different from the rest. The fact she was found in her home, she was attacked in her home, the killer was actually seen hanging out potentially nearby, it just doesn't quite seem the same. The next attack didn't happen for 9 more months, when on the 10th of January 1987, 38-year-old Barbara Agnew was returning from a ski trip with friends. They'd been skiing on the Stratton Mountain in Vermont for the day, and Barbara was last seen heading back to her home in Norwich, but she never made it. Instead, a snowplough came across a green BMW with the door slightly ajar, Barbara's car, at a rest stop on Interstate 91 in Hartford. Around this same time, an attendant at a nearby service station watched as a man approached a dumpster and pulled out an item of clothing, a ski jacket. When the attendant went out to see what was going on, this man simply dropped the jacket, got back into his car, and drove away. Curious, the attendant pulled the jacket out of the dumpster himself and found nothing unusual about it, but he did pull a wallet out of the pocket in which there was no money, but there was an ID card from the local hospital belonging to a Barbara Agnew from the hospital that she worked at. Now, this rest stop attendant really, really wanted to reunite Barbara with this jacket, so he actually called the number on the card several times over the next couple of days to try and reunite it with its owner. But of course, he only ever got Barbara's voicemail. Now, the question has always been whether or not the man seen pulling this jacket out of the dumpster originally was the one responsible for Barbara's death. Like, did he place it there himself and was pulling it back out to check something? Or was he maybe an innocent passerby with an eagle eye who saw a potential treasure?
Hey, wake up! New drinks just dropped at Wendy's. Cold foam, cold brew coffee, and sparkling energy. Both the caramel and the chocolate cold foam are just, ugh, so good. And the pineapple citrus and cherry limeade sparkling energy each have
80 to 120 milligrams
of added caffeine. So whether you need a treat first thing or to just stop yawning already, mornings hit different. To pick up a new pick-me-up, gotta be Wendy's. At participating U.S. Wendy's.
This is the story of the one. As a maintenance supervisor at a manufacturing facility, he knows keeping the line up and running is a top priority. That's why he chooses Grainger. Because when a drive belt gets damaged, Grainger makes it easy to find the exact specs for the replacement product he needs. And next day delivery helps ensure he'll have everything in place and running like clockwork. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
We don't know. Eventually, in his quest, the attendant contacted the hospital, who actually had Barbara's ex-husband listed as her emergency contact. So they contacted him. The ex-husband contacted Barbara's best friend, who said that she had gone skiing for the weekend, but she should be back by now. She had a key to Barbara's apartment though, so said she'd swing by and check on her and make sure she was okay. Only when she did so, she found it empty. Concerned, the best friend contacts the police, who immediately head to the rest stop to investigate. And it's at this point that they make the connection to the abandoned car, Barbara's car, that was found pretty nearby. Upon taking a look inside this car, they saw blood across the steering wheel and the back seat. So it was pretty clear from this point onwards that something bad had happened to Barbara, yet another missing woman in this area. After so many similar cases, I can imagine there wasn't much hope of her being found alive. But regardless, state police officers from all across Vermont jumped into action, including the mountain rescue team. They intensely searched the area surrounding the car, and in doing so, came across lots of very small clues. They found strands of hair, dark spots in the snow, which seemed to be blood. They found chewing gum. They also found multiple items inside the car. They found ski boots, ski poles, wool hats. Combined with what they found in the dumpster, like, there was everything that Barbara would have taken skiing with her. Except her skis themselves. The skis themselves had gone missing. It would later be found that they had originally been attached to the top of the car, but at some point, maybe after the car had been abandoned, somebody had taken them. The question is, was it the killer or was it just another passerby? Was it maybe the same person who had taken her jacket? Like, who else had messed with this crime scene? I wish I had the answers for you. I do not. Despite an intense investigation, Barbara wouldn't be found for 2.5 months. On March 28th, a local woman in Vermont had some visitors with her for the weekend and decided to take them out for a hike now the snow had really started to melt. As you can probably guess, on this walk on Advent Hill Road, they came across a body, still in ski gear, face down in the dirty slush. Barbara's case had been such big news in this local area that the woman said as soon as she saw the body, she knew who it was immediately, and she headed back to call the police. This was an incredibly remote area, like there were only a few houses dotted around, and it was 12 miles from the rest stop where Barbara's car had been abandoned. Just like the rest, Barbara had been stabbed repeatedly, focused on the neck and the chest. As the snow had slowed down decomposition, there was actually a lot more they could tell about Barbara's death than a lot of the others, which were just bones. She clearly displayed a number of defensive wounds. She'd fought back against her attacker and also had a disabling wound as well. Now, I assume this was to the leg, the killer trying to prevent her from running away. Once again, the pure level of violence here is abundantly clear. By this point, there are a lot of questions as to links between these women. I mean, they varied in age from teenagers, like Bernice was 17, to 38-year-old women like Barbara. They were all different in appearance. There weren't any obvious links between them. It was brought up at one point that multiple of them did have links to hospitals or the healthcare sector in general. I mean, Barbara and Ellen both worked in hospitals, Bernice was a nurse's aide, and Linda was active with the local Rockingham Hospital Auxiliary, where she served as president. Could that maybe be the connection here between a lot of the victims? But this only linked some of them, not all, and besides, how was the killer going to know if they were nurses or if they worked at a hospital? I mean, Barbara was just on her way home from a ski trip. It seemed very random. It was nothing to do with her job. Unless, of course, all the victims were pre-chosen, stalked and followed. Could the killer have also been somebody who worked at a hospital and knew them through that? But they weren't all linked with the same hospital and none of the women seemed to know each other. But back to Barbara. My big question in her case specifically is, why did she pull over her car? Like, why had she stopped at the rest stop? Had she genuinely stopped for rest, or was somebody at the side of the road pretending to be in distress? So many of these murders seem to be linked with cars, hitchhiking, cars being found in random places, Barbara's car being abandoned, like, cars seem to be a connection here. However, the Connecticut River Valley killer wasn't done with Barbara's murder. There was one more victim who miraculously survived the attack, survived to tell the tale. After this next victim, the killer wouldn't attack again, at least not under this MO in this area. Was he maybe scared that this victim knew too much, and now one wrong move and he'd get caught? It was August 6th, 1988, when 22-year-old Jane Borowski was on her way home from a county fair in Keene in New Hampshire. She was 7 months pregnant at the time and she was craving a soda, so of course she stopped to get one. She pulled into a closed convenience store in West Swansea and as she did so, made note of a car parked next to her on her passenger side. And this car was a Jeep Wagoneer. She didn't think anything of it at first, of course. I mean, this was a parking lot, cars parked there. So she just headed over to the vending machine to get herself a drink. And then she went back to her car and sat there drinking her soda. And then she noticed a man walk around the back of her car and approach her, asking her if the payphone worked. And then, before she even realised what was happening, he yanked open her door and tried to pull her out of the car. Jane, though, wasn't about to go down without a fight. She reported that she screamed so loud she broke the blood vessels in her eyes. She kicked and she fought, so much so that she smashed her windscreen. And then the man pulled out a knife, asking her if that persuaded her to get out of the car, and it did. Jane asked the man what he wanted, to which he responded that she'd beaten up his girlfriend. In that moment, she thought he was crazy, telling him that she hadn't. And then he asked her if her car was a Massachusetts car, when clearly it was New Hampshire. He was trying to throw her off perhaps, maybe create a false sense of security. So he walks round to the back of her car and looks at her license plate and sees that it is indeed New Hampshire. Jane said at this point she wasn't feeling threatened. She thought this was just a case of mistaken identity. And then the man started walking back to his car. And then Jane said the next words that came out of her mouth are something that will haunt her forever. She said to the man, "Hey asshole, what about my windshield?" At the time, she says she didn't feel threatened. She genuinely thought it was mistaken identity. Maybe it was. Maybe the killer really did pick out his victims. But that's when he came back round to Jane and held the knife against her neck. As he did so, she saw a car drive down the road, so she started to shout and scream, running towards them. She ran to the road and then got tackled down to the ground by the perpetrator. As he got her down, he started stabbing her repeatedly, and all she could think of in that moment was protecting her baby as he continued stabbing her. She was 7 months pregnant. And then apparently he just stopped. He got up calmly and walked away. He got back to his car and drove off, driving next to Jane as she got up onto her hands and knees. He looked at her as she did so, but he didn't stop to finish the job. He just continued driving, leaving her on the floor in the parking lot. And this is a baffling point, because if he knew she was alive, why did he not finish the job? Like, was he confident that she was just going to bleed out? Was he worried about getting caught if he hung around for much longer? It seems he really did think that she was just going to bleed out. I mean, he stabbed her 27 times in total, and somehow Jane survived, and so did her baby. It seems impossible, but Jane was actually able to get back in her car and drive to a friend's house for help. As she drove down the road, Route 32, she realised that her attacker's car was directly in front of her, but she was able to stop at the friend's house and call for help. As the friend came out, apparently the attacker did do a U-turn and saw her there before speeding away. And when Jane got to the hospital, it was found that she had 2 collapsed lungs, he'd cut the tendon in her hand and knee, he'd sliced her jugular and caught her liver, so she had to have a piece of it removed. And her baby didn't receive a single wound, although after birth she would be diagnosed with a very mild cerebral palsy, presumably thanks to the attack, but they don't know for sure. Jane said that she didn't know anything about serial killer in this area until after the attack. She didn't even know that she was potentially a surviving victim of the Connecticut River Valley killer until she read about it in the newspaper. Her case seemed unusual, the fact the killer was about to leave, that it seemed to be a case of mistaken identity. But was it? Was this part of his game? Give the victims a false sense of security before backtracking and attacking? With no other survivors, we don't know how this killer operated. We don't know if maybe he did the same to them, just played with them. But Jane did survive, meaning she was able to give a good account of the killer. She described his vehicle as an early 80s Jeep Wagoneer with a grain side, which I'm pretty sure means the wooden panels some older cars have sort of down the side. Somebody correct me if I'm wrong, because Google didn't really provide a clear answer, but I'm fairly sure that's what it means, like the wooden panels on the side of old cars. Jane described the attacker as a clean-shaven white man between 30 and 40, about 5'7" and 150 to 160 pounds with blonde hair. They took scrapings from under her fingernails because she had fought so hard, it was likely she caught him and got some of his DNA. And they also dusted the entire car for fingerprints, and I'm pretty sure they did find some. But obviously, it's now 2024 and they still haven't caught the perpetrator, so we can assume that all of that amounted to nothing. It might mean they do indeed have DNA evidence on file though, perhaps they're waiting it out until technology is advanced enough to finally test it.
If you've been thinking about getting serious with your money, like actually serious, now's the time. The Motley Fool is offering new members 50% off their iconic stock recommendation service, Stock Advisor. This is the same service that's crushed the market with recommendations that have returned 1,057% since inception, compared to the S&P 500's 180% over that same period. This isn't guesswork. The Motley Fool has a track record of finding companies before they become household names. So if you want to invest smarter and you like saving money while doing it, go to fool.com/listen to claim your 50% off discount off a 1-year term of Stock Advisor. Again, that's fool.com/listen. Returns of 1,057% are from the Motley Fool's product Stock Advisor and measured against S&P 500 returns of 180% as of July 10th, 2025. Past performance is not an indicator of future results. All investing involves a risk of loss. Individual investment results may vary.
You eat well, you work out, but did you know 99% of Americans are still mineral deficient? That's where Concentrace Daily Mineral Powder comes in. It's your daily foundation for better mood, natural energy, immune support, and nervous system balance. Formulated from nature and backed by science, it's a simple habit that makes a big impact. Because your body doesn't make minerals, and today's food and water don't supply enough, with Concentrace, you'll feel the difference. Go to TraceMinerals.com and start with minerals. Start with Concentrace.
I mean, obviously DNA tech is pretty good already, but each time you test DNA and you fail to get results, it decreases the quality of the sample. They might have so little DNA that it means they can't afford to test it and get it wrong. They've got to wait until they know it will actually yield results. Or perhaps they don't have DNA at all, we don't know for sure. Only recently they solved one of the cases in the Colonial Parkway murders through old DNA though, so we have got to have hope. It's widely believed by investigators that Jane was indeed the final victim of the Connecticut River Valley killer, that after his failed attempt at killing her, he got spooked and decided not to risk being caught. Maybe by this time he'd got cocky, maybe he thought he could leave her on the brink of death and let her bleed out, dying slowly. Perhaps he did get spooked at the scene and had to leave. But now with such a detailed description of him, a surviving witness, Perhaps he knew that he couldn't continue this any longer. Honestly, I do think that if there were further attacks after Jane, I would question whether or not this was indeed the work of the same killer. But the fact that he did go quiet after this, I think it does say a lot. However, there are some other possible victims of this man. The eight women I've detailed up to this point are considered to be connected or thought to have been committed by the same person by investigators. The ones I'm about to share could be linked, but it's not 100%. On June 11th, 1968, 15-year-old Joanne Dunham was walking to the bus stop on her way to school in Charlestown, New Hampshire. She disappeared, her body being found the next day in Unity, the same place that many other victims were found. However, this is an outlier, as Joanne was found asphyxiated, not stabbed, and this was also over a decade before the rest of the murders. On October 5th, 1982, 76-year-old Sylvia Gray was found bludgeoned and stabbed to death in a wooded area near her home in Plainfield, New Hampshire. She'd been reported as missing just the day before. 4 years later, the body of a 38-year-old man called Stephen Hill would also be found in the same spot, stabbed to death. On May 20th, 1984, 16-year-old Heidi Lee Martin had gone out for a jog in Heartland in Vermont. The next day, her body was found behind the local elementary school. She'd been raped and stabbed to death. And a 21-year-old man would later confess to this crime and was tried. But then he would recant his confession and he was acquitted. So her case remains unsolved to this very day. Barbara Agnew's body was found only about a mile away 3 years later. June 24th, 1989, partial decomposed remains were found alongside Massachusetts Route 78 in Warwick in Massachusetts. This was just arms and legs belonging to a woman, and the body seemed to have been dismembered, with the head and torso never being found. Obviously, this death was ruled as a homicide and the woman has never been identified. As far as I could see, a cause of death hasn't been released, or just they don't know it. And then finally, on July 25th, 1989, 14-year-old Carrie Moss left her home in New Boston in New Hampshire to go and visit a friend, and she disappeared. Her remains will be found 2 years later in a wooded area, and again, her cause of death could not be ascertained, but it's always been investigated as a homicide. If Carrie was indeed a victim of the Connecticut River Valley Killer, her attack came almost a year after Jane's, but obviously, she didn't survive. We don't know if this was the same person. I think it's quite obvious in each of these cases why they can't be fully connected, but also could maybe be connected. Now, in terms of suspects in this case, I couldn't really find any detailed online. There's only one, a man called Michael Nicolau. Nicolau came to the authorities' attention on December 31st, 2005 after he shot and killed his wife, Eileen Nicolau, and her 22-year-old daughter, Taryn Bowman, before then killing himself. He was a 56-year-old Vietnam War veteran living near Tampa, Florida, who had a very shady past. In the late 1980s, he'd been in a serious relationship with a woman called Michelle, and they lived in Holyoke in Massachusetts with their two children. Michelle described him to friends and family as possessive and angry with severe PTSD from his time in the war. Their relationship was so incredibly volatile that in the end, Michelle just had to take their kids and run one day, just go into hiding. But it seems like he found her because none of them have been heard from since November 1988, after it was found out that Michael discovered their location. Michelle's family have searched for them for years, and in 2000 they hired a private investigator to try and find her, or at least find out what happened to her. And they've always believed that Michael killed her and the kids. The PI got in contact with our survivor Jane as part of her research, and she became convinced that Michael Nicolau was the one responsible for her attack, even coming out publicly with this information in 2006. However, Jane has since said that she's no longer entirely sure that Nicolau was responsible. She said the PI spent a lot of time trying to convince her. They shared a lot of information that made the timelines really fit, but since learning more, she said she doesn't believe it quite works. She said that Nicolau can't be excluded, but she's not certain it's him. And she's seen his face, she's seen photos of Nicolau, and she's seen the face of her attacker. Surely she'd know if it was the same person. Although trauma can do awful things to memory, I suppose, so maybe not. There have been multiple calls for Nicolau's DNA to be tested against that of the River Valley killer to set this question to bed once and for all. But there doesn't really seem to be any rush to do so, which again I think brings us round to the possibility of them not wanting to risk wasting the DNA they have on only a potential suspect, because the PI thinks that it's the same person. The actual authorities, they don't really think it is. Like, he's never been an official police suspect. Nicolau's name is the only one though that really comes up in connection with this case. There are a few random names mentioned online by random web sleuths, but nothing else I really feel strongly enough to detail. And I couldn't even really find like a solid profile detailed anywhere online of the man we're looking for. Apparently there was one on an old Unsolved Mysteries episode about Jane's case, but for the life of me, I couldn't find the episode anywhere. All we have is the words of the potential witnesses of the man outside Linda Moore's house and Jane's word. And it's not a given that both of those men were one and the same. We don't know they're the same suspect. I do find myself wondering in this case if perhaps there were two killers at work, somebody maybe responsible for the bodies found in Unity, and then perhaps somebody responsible for the rest of them. I also wonder if Linda Moore's case was that of a separate killer entirely. Her being approached in her home and her body being left inside seems totally different from the rest, unless the killer got interrupted. Like, the MO was just not the same there. There are also a lot of theories online actually that two men might have been involved in all the murders. We know that Bernice was last seen getting into a car with two men, and there was also a witness who called in to say that they saw a woman being forced into a van by two men near a rest area in Barbara Agnew's case. Although we know that Jane was only attacked by one man, could that have been an entirely different perpetrator? Or could it have just been one of the men going rogue? So if we're looking at witness descriptions of the man who was last seen outside Linda Moore's house, we're looking for a white man, probably, who was in his 20s or early 30s in the 80s, with dark hair and dark rimmed glasses. But as I've said, I'm not completely convinced that Linda's case was connected. Either way though, this man may be responsible for a murder. And then Jane described her attacker as clean-shaven, white, between 30 and 40, about 5'7", 150 pounds, with blonde hair, which is quite vague and not all that much help, but you never know. The perpetrator likely lived in the New England area, either Vermont or New Hampshire, or at least he visited this area fairly regularly for work. He was the kind of person who liked being in control, and he also liked being in control of the victims, liked being the decider as to whether they lived or died, and perhaps that can be seen in the case of Jane Borowski. It also seems like this man drove around a lot, always on the search for his next victim, an unsuspecting woman on the roads, hitchhiking or otherwise. In terms of what is currently being done in this case, I really couldn't find any recent updates at all. As we've already covered, we know they have DNA and they also do have fingerprints. I'm sure at some point it will be tested, but it hasn't been done yet, or at least I couldn't find this case listed on any of my usual sites like Othram, etc. So it doesn't seem like it's being tested, but it might be behind the scenes, I don't know. And even then, solving just one of these cases doesn't necessarily mean solving all of them. Whilst we assume that all these cases are the work of the same killer or killers, we don't know. I refer back to the Colonial Parkway case again. The murders of couple David Nobling and Robin Edwards have been linked to Alan Wilmer Sr. through DNA, but as far as we're aware, none of the rest have been. And so we just wait. That's all we've got to do in this case. We just wait. And maybe, if you get the word out enough, somebody might come forward with something. I don't know. But if you happen to live in New Hampshire, if you've got relatives, friends who are alive in this era in the 80s who might know something, just talk about the story, just share it with them. You never know. Especially if you live around Unity, that really seems to be a hotspot for this killer. Thank you so much for tuning in today, and I'll see you in the next one. Bye guys.